Orlando had expected it would be. The two Diamala refused to run or even to hurry. A matter of dignity, apparently. And they were no more than halfway to the door when the crowd waiting two bays down spotted them. Fortunately, having no compunctions of his own against a little judicious haste, Lando had already reached the other side and was keying the door open by the time the mob started its belated surge toward them. The Diamala made it inside in plenty of time, with only a few minor fruit juice stains from glancing impacts as souvenirs.
"They are barbarians," the aide said,
his voice icy cold, as Lando sealed the door behind them.
"No being should have the right to attempt such dishonoring of another."
"Peace,"
Myotomia said, in the same tone as he flicked a few drops of juice from his sleeve with his fingertips.
"Few other beings have the wisdom or capacity for proper expression that characterize the Diamala. Rather than considering them as barbarians to be shunned, or even as wrongdoers to be punished, you must see them as children who merely need instruction in civilized behavior."
He looked at Lando.
"Do you not agree?"
"I think any such discussion should be postponed, Senator," Lando said, not about to let himself get dragged into that kind of conversation. "At least until we're safely off Silpar."
"You speak wisdom,"
Myotomia said, his ears twitching again.
"Please, lead the way."
Tierce looked up from the display, and from his expression alone, Deesra knew he'd hit solid ore.
"You have a target?" he asked.
"I do indeed," Tierce said. "Senator Parolo Myotomia, Diamolan representative to the New Republic."
He swiveled the display around to face the other.
"And you'll never guess who he's hitched a ride with."
Deesra scanned the report, feeling his own eyes widen a little.
"They must be joking. Lando Calrissian?"
"No joke,"
Tierce assured him.
"And no error, either. The reporting agent back-checked against the Mos Tomro spaceport lift records. Calrissian, the senator, and the senator's aide all took off together in Calrissian's yacht."
"Did they indeed?" Deesra murmured.
No wonder Tierce was looking so self-satisfied. The Diamala were even louder advocates of the forgive-and-forget attitude than either the Mon Calamari or the Duros. An ideal choice for the little drama Tierce had in mind. And to have a close friend of Han Solo's along for the ride made it even more perfect.
"What's their destination?" "Oh, here it is. Coruscant."
"Yes."
Tierce had called up a star chart and was laying rate of passage track lines across it.
"Assuming Calrissian heads straight for Coruscant, we should have no trouble intercepting them wherever we want along the way. The only question is whether Flim and I can rendezvous with the Relentless before they grab the yacht."
"It won't look good if they have to wait for you to show up," Deesra warned. "This is supposed to look like one of Thrawn's casual omniscience tricks."
"Kindly do not lecture me on the subtleties of my own plans,"
Tierce said coldly, manipulating the track lines across the starfield.
"It'll be a bit tight, but I think we can manage it."
"Yes," Deesra said as he looked over the numbers himself. "I'm still not wild about this plan, Tierce. We have no idea how the New Republic will react."
"Of course we know,"
Tierce said patiently.
"I've already explained all of that to you."
"You've given me your guesses," Deesra corrected. "But that's all they are. Guesses."
"If you're not willing to take some risks, you shouldn't have started this scheme in the first place,"
Tierce said, his voice chilling a few degrees.
"It's still not too late for you to back out if you've lost your nerve."
Deesra glared at him.
"It's not a question of my nerve, Major," he growled.
It's a question of not taking unnecessary risks to achieve our objective."
Tierce met his gaze evenly.
"This one is necessary, Your Excellency,"
he said.
"Trust me. Now we'll need an interdictor cruiser, too."
He lifted his eyebrows slightly.
"And we're on something of a tight schedule here."
With an effort, Deesra swallowed back the rest of his argument. Tierce hadn't sprung this new scheme on him until after his return from Yaga Minor, and he still wasn't sure how the guardsmen had talked him into it. But if they were going to do it, they'd blazing well better do it right. "Fine," he growled. "Get out of my chair and I'll issue the orders."
Chapter 16.
"Well, General,"
Admiral Pellion said, leaning back in his seat as he accepted a small glass of Corius brandy from the other.
"How are things at Yaga Minor?"
"About the same as always, Admiral,"
High General Hestiv said, waving at the distant planet centered in his office viewport, as he poured a little of the brandy into his own glass and sat down again behind his data card-strewn desk.
"Very quiet."
"I understand there's been some recent unrest among segments of the Yagai population,"
Pellion said.
"Completely negligible,"
Hestiv said, waving a hand in dismissal.
"Actually, since the overwhelming majority of the populace is completely loyal, they mostly take care of the handful of dissenters themselves. The only time we normally have to lift a finger is to protect the dissidents from overzealous loyalists."
"Allowing you to take the moral high ground."
"Exactly,"
Hestiv said.
"It makes for a refreshing change from our usual image among aliens."
"Yes,"
Pellion murmured, sipping his drink.
"A pity the Emperor didn't work harder at that kind of public relations himself 20 years ago."
"A pity someone who wasn't so insanely blind with power didn't overthrow him while there was still time,"
Hestiv countered, an edge of bitterness in his voice.
"There must have been hundreds of competent administrators or fleet officers who could have kept the Empire alive."
Pellion felt a catch in his throat.
"There was one, at least,"
he said quietly. Hestiv's lip twitched.
"Yes, Grand Admiral Thrawn. I've always regretted the fact that I never had the chance to meet him."
For a moment, the two men sat in silence. Then Hestiv cleared his throat.
"But I don't suppose it gains us anything to count the might-have-beens," he said. "That was the past. This is the present. And I presume, Admiral, that you're here to discuss the future."
Pellion took another sip of his drink.
"Yes,"
he said, watching the other closely.
"To put it bluntly, the war against the New Republic is over, and we've lost. In my professional military opinion, it's time to talk peace."
The muscles around Hestiv's eyes tightened.
"You mean surrender?"
"I'll be negotiating for terms,"
Pellion said.
"If I do a proper job, I think we should be able to keep most of what we have."
Hestiv snorted.
"Such as it is."
"We still control over 1,000 inhabited systems,"
Pellion reminded him mildly.
"Would you prefer we allow the New Republic to whittle that number down further before we accept the inevitable?"
"The New Republic's in no shape to do much whittling at the moment,"
Hestiv said.
"It looks to me like they're poised to go for each other's throats, not ours."
"Certainly they have problems,"
Pellion said.
"But if you're expecting them to collapse into a full-fledged civil war over Kaar Mas or anything else, I think you're being unrealistic."
"Begging the Admiral's pardon, but I respectfully disagree,"
Hestiv said.
"Particularly if we engaged in a little judicious pushing of our own."
Pellion stifled a sigh. Yet another argument he'd heard over and over again on this trip.
"So you'd have us encourage them in their self-destruction,"
he said.
"Emptying your shipyards if necessary, draining all the manpower and resources from your ubiquitous base, leaving this system totally defenseless."
"If it's necessary to go that far, yes," Hestive said. "This is a military base, Admiral. That's how its resources are supposed to be used."
"Granted,"
Pelion said with a nod.
"What do you suppose will happen when they find out we've been goading them?"
"There's no reason they need to find out," Hestive argued. "We don't have to use our Star Destroyers or TIE Fighters or anything else obviously Imperial."
"No,"
Pelion shook his head.
"We can keep up such a charade for a while, maybe even a long while, but in the end they'll find out, and then they'll unite again, at least long enough to destroy us."
Hestive looked out the window at the blue-green sphere in the distance.
"At least that way we'd go down fighting," he said with obvious difficulty. "Your way... There's no honor in surrender, Admiral."
"There's no honor in wasting lives for nothing, either,"
Pelion countered. Hestive smiled wryly.
"I know. But at least if you're dead, you don't have to live with the shame of it."
"There are some in the fleet who would call that a noble warrior attitude,"
Pelion said.
"Personally, I'd call it stupid. If we're destroyed, if we all die, the concepts and ideals of the New Order die with us. But if we surrender, we can keep those ideals alive. Then, if and when the New Republic self-destructs, we'll be positioned to rise again. Maybe then the galaxy will finally be ready to accept us."
Hestive grimaced.
"Perhaps."
"There's no disgrace in backing out of a no-win situation, General,"
Pelion said quietly.
"I saw Grand Admiral Thrawn do it more than once, forthrightly and without embarrassment, rather than waste his men and ships. That's no more or less what I'm proposing we do now."
Hestive swirled his drink restlessly in his glass.
"I presume you've already consulted with the Moffs about this?"
"I have,"
Pelion said.
"In the end, they agreed."
"Reluctantly, I suppose."
"None of us is exactly enthusiastic about it,"
Pelion said.
"We simply recognize that it has to be done."
Hestive took a deep breath, exhaled it.
"I suppose you're right. I wish you weren't."
He lifted his glass, drained it in a single swallow.
"Very well, Admiral. You have my support, which I presume was the real reason you came to Yagga Minor. Is there anything else I can do for you?"
"As a matter of fact, there is,"
Pelion said, pulling out a data card and handing it across the desk.
"First of all, I'd like you to run this list of names through the ubiquitous base's computer system."
"Certainly,"
Hestive said, sliding the data card into its slot and keying his terminal.
"Anything in particular you're looking for?"
"Unaltered information,"
Pelion told him.
"These are people I suspect of having shady financial ties to Moff Deesra, but we haven't been able to track the connections."
"And Deesra wouldn't let you look through the Bastion records?"
Hestive suggested, with a wry smile.
"I'm sure he would have,"
Pelion said.
"I just don't happen to think I'd be able to trust what those records said."
"Well, you can trust these,"
Hestive assured him, keying his board.
"No one gets into my records without proper and double-confirmed authorization. That major from the Obliterator, Tierce, certainly found that out when he tried to..."
"Major Tierce?"
Pelion interrupted him.
"Major Grodin Tierce?"
"Yes, that's the one,"
Hestive said, frowning.
"He was here on behalf of Captain Trazin, Only we couldn't make contact with the Obliterator to confirm the authorization, so we wouldn't let him into the system. Why? Is something wrong?
Yes,
Pelion gritted.
Major Tierce isn't attached to the Obliterator. He's Moff Deethra's aide.
Hestiv's expression turned to stone.
Is he now?
Pelion gestured toward the terminal.
Is there any way to tell which records he might have tapped into?
I just told you he didn't get in.
Oh, he got in all right,
Pelion said darkly.
Through a terminal no one was watching, or perhaps he brought one of his own and tapped in at a junction point. But he most certainly didn't leave without whatever it was he came here to do.
Hestiv was keying his board.
You're right, of course. I'll order a check, and while we're at it, let's have them run his ID again.
The examination took just under an hour, and in the end, they found what Pelion had begun to suspect they would find. Nothing.
This doesn't make any sense,
Hestiv growled, glaring at his display.
We know he was here, and presumably not just for his health, but there isn't a single sign of access or tampering. So what in blazes did he do?
Did you check all the records?
Pelion asked, swiveling the display around and running an eye down the listing.
Of course we did,
Hestiv said, his tone a little huffy.
Everything from the basic maintenance files on up to...
No,
Pelion said, staring at the display as a sudden chilling thought hit him.
You didn't check everything. You couldn't have.
Begging the Admiral's pardon, I...
Because there are records you don't have access to.
Pelion cut him off, scrolling down the listing.
Specifically, the special files section.
Hestiv's eyebrows lifted.
You can't be serious, he said. Are you suggesting a lowly major could access the Emperor's own sealed records?
I agree it sounds unbelievable,
Pelion said.
But we're running out of options.
But a major?
He's an aide to a very slippery Moff,
Pelion reminded him.
I wouldn't put it past Deethra to have found a way into the special files. In fact, considering his ambition and lack of discernible ethics, I'd probably find it more surprising if he hadn't.
I still don't believe it, Hestiv said heavily. But as you say, we're running out of options.
He cocked an eyebrow.
I don't suppose you can get us into those records to check this out.
Pelion shook his head.
The codes and procedures were lost long before I rose to the position where I would have been instructed in their use.
Pity, Hestiv said. If we can't get in, we aren't going to be able to figure out what he was doing in there.
That is the big question, isn't it?
Pelion agreed, rubbing his chin thoughtfully.
He couldn't have been looking up something. The records at Bastion are duplicates of the ones here, which implies his purpose was to add, delete, or alter.
Hestiv muttered something under his breath.
Which implies those names you're investigating may have more of a history with the Empire than you thought.
Perhaps.
Pelion agreed soberly, as another unpleasant thought struck him.
But there's one other possibility. If I wanted details on the attack that destroyed Karmas, where would I look?
Hestiv shrugged slightly.
There should be copies of all the media and official reports in the regular files, both current time and follow-up.
And if Palpatine was personally involved, as the rumors suggested?
Hestiv exhaled noisily.
Ugh. Anything like that would be in the special files section, wouldn't it? You think that's what Tierce was really after?
Or he was after that plus Deesra's ally list,
Pelion said.
As long as he was in the files anyway, why not do both?
Why not indeed?
Hestiv said, drumming his fingers thoughtfully on the desktop.
The question is, what would Deesra want with the Karmas files?
Whatever it is, I doubt very much that it has anything other than Deesra's personal aggrandizement at the core,
Pelion said sourly.
And for that reason alone, I want to know what it is. I think, General, that the two of us ought to begin a quiet search for someone who might be able to access those records for us.
I'll begin making inquiries immediately, Hestev promised. Where can I contact you if I'm successful?
I'll be out of contact for a while,
Pelion said, standing up.
I'll communicate with you when I get back. Thank you for your assistance.
Any time, Admiral, Hestev said. And best of luck with everything.
And it was finally time, Pelion knew, as he headed down the corridor from Hestev's office toward the docking bay where his shuttle was berthed. The Yaga Minor shipyards were the last stop on his tour of the Empire's meager defensive facilities, and he had gleaned as much support from the senior military as he was going to get. It was time now for the lonely journey to Pasatine. He grimaced. It had been 3 weeks now. 3 weeks since Major Vermel would have arrived at Morishim to try to contact General Bel Iblis. 3 weeks since he and his Corellian corvette had vanished without a single trace. The increasingly unavoidable conclusion was that he'd been intercepted somewhere along the way, either by random pirates, overeager New Republic forces, or dissident Imperials. He'd been a good officer, even a friend, and Pelion would mourn his loss and miss his service. But at the moment, the critical question was whether he'd been able to deliver his message before that interception occurred. There was no way for Pelion to know. He would simply have to show up at Pasatine and see if Bel Iblis did likewise. And if the other did not, well, he would deal with that when and if it became necessary.
Chapter 17. Its official name was the Grand Rim Promenade, and even on a world that prided itself on engineering achievements as much as St. Jansage clearly did, it was a remarkable achievement indeed. 30 meters wide at its greatest expanse, attached to the eastern wall of the Canyonade, about two-thirds of the way from floor to rim, it stretched the entire length, over 10 kilometers, of the canyon. Small trade and vending booths were set up all along the canyon wall, the commercial areas interspersed with conversation circles or tiny contoured meditation gardens or sculpture clusters. At other spots, the wall had been left completely open to allow unobstructed observation of interesting natural vegetation clumps or the small waterfalls that dribbled softly down toward the canyon floor below. The far more interesting view, though, was on the other side of the promenade. Beyond the chest-high, elaborately tooled metal mesh guard wall, one could look down into the canyonade itself, to the city that had been created across the floor and sides. At regular intervals, the guard wall opened up into the sky arches that curved gracefully across the canyon to the lesser and more utilitarian walkways on the far side. The sky arches were arranged in diamond-patterned groups of 9, 3 connecting with the promenade, 2 each connecting with the walkways above and below it, 1 each from the walkways above and below those. An impressive achievement, made all the more so by the fact that the entire 300-year-old structure was held solidly in place without any repulsor lift support whatsoever. Walking along the promenade, gazing across through the gathering darkness at the scattering of lights across the canyon and down below, Luke wondered if anyone in these modern days would have both the skill and the self-confidence to undertake anything of this magnitude. Rolling along at Luke's side, R2 twittered uneasily. Don't worry, R2. I'm not going to get too close to the edge, Luke soothed to the little droid, shifting his shoulders beneath his hooded cloak. Anyway, it's not dangerous. The brochure said there are emergency tractor beams set up to catch anyone who falls. R2 warbled a not entirely convinced acknowledgement. Then, rotating his dome for a surreptitious look behind them,
he beeped a question. Yes, Luke told him soberly. He's still following us. Had been following them, in fact, since shortly after their arrival on the promenade. A large, bulky alien, slipping in and out of the other pedestrians with unlikely grace. Luke wasn't sure exactly when he and R2 had been spotted and identified. Possibly during the turbolift ride down from the spaceport. Possibly not until they'd arrived on the promenade itself. For that matter, it was entirely possible they hadn't been identified at all. Their tale could simply be a local thief, hoping to relieve a helpless stranger of his astromech droid. If so, he was going to be in for a surprise. R2 twittered again. Patience, Luke told him, looking around. They'd come to the end of one of the groups of wall-hugging businesses now, and were starting into a wide area that featured only a waterfall and two currently unoccupied conversation areas. Quiet, peaceful, and as private as Luke had yet seen up here. An ideal place for holding an impromptu conversation. Or for springing an ambush. Let's pause here a moment, he said to R2, crossing over toward the outer edge of the promenade. They were roughly in the middle of the quiet area now, with the waterfall rippling softly behind them. Picking a section of guard wall, Luke stopped walking and leaned his elbows on the top rail, stretching out to the force as he did so. There was a subtle change in the emotions of their pursuer now, a change that felt to Luke like the other had made a decision. He's coming, Luke muttered to R2. I think he's alone, but there could still be trouble. Keep back out of the way, all right? The droid acknowledged with a nervous twitter, rolling a meter back in response. Resettling his elbows on the guard wall, Luke gazed out into the canyonade, a gentle shiver running up his back as he listened to the quiet footsteps approaching from the side. As near as he could tell, this was the exact spot where he'd seen himself in that vision. The footsteps stopped.
Pardon me,
a gentle voice asked.
Are you the Jedi Master, Luke Skywalker?
Luke turned, getting his first clear look at the being who'd been following them. He was of an unfamiliar species, tall and broad, with dark shell plates half hidden beneath a fur-trimmed cloak. His head was large, with alert black eyes and small spikes where the mouth would be on a human. I'm Skywalker, yes, Luke confirmed. And you?
I am Moshin Tree, Unyala of the Custa tribe of the Reloran people of Reldos Minor.
He reached a Wookiee-sized hand to the collar of his cloak and turned the edge back. Fastened on the underside was a distinctive gold filigree pin.
I am also a New Republic observer. I am honored to meet you, sir.
And are you? Luke said, nodding in greeting as his last vestiges of tension faded away. The observers were an experimental, quasi-official part of the New Republic, created in this latest round of governmental policy reorganization. Moving freely about their assigned sectors, their job was to report directly to the High Council and Senate whatever they saw or heard, with a particular eye toward improper governmental activities that the local or sector authorities might prefer to keep out of sight. There had been some early fears that the observers might evolve into the kind of secret security forces that the Empire had used with such devastating effect during its reign of terror. So far, though, that didn't seem to be happening. The various governments that had undertaken to sponsor observers had chosen their candidates carefully, with an eye toward hiring only strongly ethical beings, and then strictly defining the limits of their mandate. The fact that the observers were assigned to sectors far away from their homes and any local or species rivalries undoubtedly helped encourage their sponsors to pick candidates who were as incorruptible and impartial as possible. A similar system had been used in the Old Republic, Luke knew, with the Jedi Knights acting in the Observer's role. Perhaps someday his Academy graduates would be numerous enough and trusted enough to once again take on that duty. "What may I do to help you?" he asked.
"Please forgive my impertinence in walking within your shadow,"
Trey continued.
"But I felt a burden to speak with you and needed to be certain of your identity before I approached."
"I understand," Luke said. "No harm done. How may I help you?" The R'Lauren stepped up to the guard wall beside Luke and waved a massive hand downward.
"I wished you to see what is happening in the Canyonade tonight. To see and to understand."
Luke turned back to the guard wall and looked down. All he could see were the normal street and vehicle lights of a modern city. "Where am I supposed to be looking?"
"There,"
Tree said, pointing toward a large diamond-shaped area near the center of the canyonade, directly across from where the two of them stood. Though bordered by normal street illumination, the area itself was almost completely dark, with only a handful of tiny lights showing near the center. "It looks like a park," Luke hazarded, mentally calling up the map of the canyonade he'd looked at on the way into the spaceport. "Tranquility Common, perhaps?"
"That is correct. Do you see the lights in the center?"
"Yes. They're..." He paused, frowning. In the past few seconds, as he and Tree had been speaking, the number of lights had seemingly doubled. Still grouped closely together, and then, even as he watched, a new circle of lights was added to the group.
"They are lights of peace. Tonight, the people of Sejansij gather together in support of justice."
"Yes," Luke said. He could see all too well where this was going. "Justice."
"I perceive from your tone of voice that you do not yet understand,"
Tree said. His own tone one of mild reproof.
"The High Council and Senate dismiss all such demonstrations as riots by the violent or ignorant, or else as plots by the Empire. But such is not always the case."
"I don't think the Senate sees things quite that simplistically," Luke said. Still, he had to admit that Tree had a point. "So what third category would the demonstration down there fall into?"
"As I said, the support of justice. The white lights you see are in remembrance of the peoples of Kamas. Soon now. Yes, there. Do you see?"
Luke nodded. Around the group of white lights, a thin circle of blue lights had appeared. As he watched, more were added, creating an ever-growing ring of blue around the white. "I see them."
"They signify the remembrance for the victims of the Varash slaughter. The land the perpetrators gained by that act has yielded great wealth to them. Yet neither the Pasic government nor the New Republic has insisted that any of that wealth be given to the survivors' families, as both the custom and ancient law of that world demand."
"One of my Jedi students was of the Varash," Luke said, his heart stirring at the memory. "He had a great deal of anger to work through before his training could properly begin."
"Their rage is understandable. Yet there is no such anger in those gathered below."
He gestured again toward the growing circle of lights.
"Not in the way humans define anger. They are quiet and peaceful. threatening no one. But they will not forget those who were wronged, nor will they allow those in power to forget.
Yes, Luke murmured. There are indeed some things that must never be forgotten. For a few minutes they stood in silence and watched. The circle of blue lights continued to grow, and then, as the white center had given way to blue, the blue gave way to yellow. The yellow was joined and encircled in turn by red, and then by pale green, then violet, and finally an outer ring of white.
They are all gathered,
Tree said, when the series of concentric rings was complete.
Those are the ones who have tonight donated their time in remembrance. Others will donate their time other nights, and as all look down upon the lights, they too will remember. And all of Sanjansij will strengthen in their resolve to petition the seats of power until all such wrongs are righted.
Luke shook his head. Except that none of these wrongs can be righted, Unyala Tree. Not Ka'amas, not any of them.
The Sanjansiji understand that. They know the dead cannot be brought back to life, nor devastated worlds be made whole again. They merely seek such justice as is within the power of mortal beings to grant.
And what justice would they seek for Ka'amas? The punishment of the entire Bothan race for the crimes of a few?
Many would say that such would not be true justice, but others would not share that opinion, and their voices too must be heard.
He pointed to the circles of lights.
But now see, they demonstrate that justice cannot be limited to any one people or event. Justice must exist for all.
Luke frowned. The neat circles were breaking up, the different colors starting to mix together at the edges. His first thought was that the demonstration had ended, and the participants were starting to leave. But the overall group of lights didn't seem to be getting any larger. The colors continued to bleed together, the rings giving way to a more homogeneous mix of color. And suddenly, he understood. The participants were leaving their own circles of remembrance and interweaving with the people in the other circles. It was a quiet yet deeply moving demonstration of unity.
Some of those now in the common do indeed believe that the entire Bothan species should be held accountable for the crime of Ka'amas. At least in regard to reparations to the surviving Ka'amasi. Other Sanjansiji reject that argument, yet agree that in suppressing knowledge of their part in the crime, the Bothan leadership has fortified any right to claims of innocence. There will also be visiting off-worlders in the common, holding lights alongside them whose opinions will be equally varied.
Sounds like it's about the same here as everywhere else in the galaxy.
True. The point I wish to make, Master Skywalker, is that these differences are not the result of enemy plots or even posturing among political rivals. They are the genuine and honest differences of opinion among the many beings who make up the New Republic. To dismiss any of them as unimportant or unthinking is to insult the honor and integrity of those beings and their cultures.
I know. I'm sure the Senate does, too. The problem is how to reconcile all those differences. Not just over Ka'amas, but also in 1,000 other matters.
I do not know how you will succeed. I only know that it must be done. And that it must be done quickly. Already I have heard the stirrings of genuine anger at the Senate's inaction on this matter. There are other, even more disturbing stirrings, whispered suggestions that the New Republic no longer cares what any world does against its neighbors or adversaries. Even now, some are preparing to settle old grievances, while others seek new alliances for protection.
Luke sighed. I've lost track of how many times the New Republic government has been accused of being too heavy-handed in one crisis or another over the past few years. Now they're trying to let the sectors and systems do more of their own governing, so of course they're being accused of doing nothing.
Does this surprise you? The one truism in all politics is that loud voices will be raised against any decision that is made.
Yes, Luke said, looking down at the flickering lights below.
Many of those now demonstrating will be gathering later tonight at the Fox of Freedom Tapcalf. It is on the far side of the common, at the western corner of the diamond. If you choose to meet with them, they will be pleased to speak their thoughts to you.
I'm sure they will, Luke said, carefully hiding a grimace. Thank you for taking your time to show me this.
It is my sworn duty to provide information to the leaders of the New Republic. It is a swearing I take most seriously.
He placed his fingertips together and inclined his head.
I thank you in turn for your time and attention, Master Skywalker. And I urge you to visit the Thoughts Are Freedom this night. You will gain much knowledge there.
Inclining his head again, he turned and headed back along the promenade. Behind Luke, R2 whistled softly, and he turned to see the little droid standing up on mechanical tiptoe as he gazed at the lights of the canyonade below. It's impressive, all right, Luke agreed soberly. That's what makes this so hard to deal with. So much of it really is honest differences of opinion. R2 warbled again, his dome swiveling pointedly in the direction of the sky arch to their left, the direction they would go to get across the canyonade and down to the tapcalf Tree had mentioned. I suppose we ought to go take a look, Luke said reluctantly. Though I doubt we'll get any new information there. It'll be just more opinions. He pushed away from the guard wall and started walking toward the entrance to the sky arch. If you want real information, you have to go to someone like Talon Card, he continued, as R2 rolled alongside like a well-trained pet. In fact, I've been thinking that maybe we ought to try to get in touch with him. R2 made a rude-sounding noise. I hope that's for the current attitude toward him on Coruscant, and not for Card himself. He's done a lot for the New Republic. The droid gave an ambiguous twitter, followed by a remarkably good impression of a pile of coins clinking together. Yes, I know he's been paid for his help. You might remember that money was the reason Han first got involved with the rebellion, too, and he's turned out pretty good. They reached the entrance to the sky arch and stepped onto the umbrella-roofed, guard-walled bridge. Like the Rim Promenade itself, the canyonade's sky arches were remarkable examples of engineering skill, curving gently and gracefully across the half-kilometer gorge without the benefit of extra supports or suspension cables. The right side of the walkway was finished in a simple, non-slip surface. clearly designed for casual strollers or those who wanted to pause and linger over the view of the canyonade below. The left side, in contrast, was equipped with a pair of slideways for the serious traveler who merely wished to go from one side to the other. It would have been a pleasant walk, Luke thought with a quiet pang of regret, but he didn't seem to have the time lately for such simple pleasures. The important point is that Card has always come to us first with information that we need, he added to R2, ushering the droid onto the slideway and stepping on behind him. Whether he admits it or not, he really is on our side. R2 swiveled his dome around to face Luke, made an I-suppose-so sort of grunt, then rotated back to face forward again. The slideway was speeding up, Luke noted with interest, accelerating steadily as they approached the center of the arch. Presumably the entire strip wasn't speeding up, which would create quite a challenge for anyone trying to get onto the strip behind him. Composed of some kind of pseudo-fluid material, he guessed, using a variant of laminar flow to create variable speeds along its length. One more engineering marvel to add to the list. They reached the top of the arch, and he was just thinking of asking R2 to analyze the slideway for him, when he felt a flicker in the force. It wasn't much, little more than a twinge in the near distance, but it was enough. Somewhere very near at hand, someone was preparing for murder. He stepped off the slideway, fighting for a moment with the abrupt change in speed before he regained his balance. R2, suddenly missing him, squawked in surprise, then squawked again as Luke stretched out with the force and lifted him bodily into the air. Quiet, Luke admonished, as he set the droid down on the stationary section of the walkway. Looking around, he stretched out again with the force. The murderous intent was still there, somewhere close by. But though there were a handful of other pedestrians in sight, there was nothing he could see that appeared to fit the sensation. At least, not on this particular sky arch. He turned around, peering upward beneath the edge of his sky arch's roof and through the guard wall mesh of the sky arch running parallel one level above him. And there they were, perhaps 10 meters farther along from where he stood. Two cloaked and hooded figures standing with their backs pressed against the guard wall. The smaller, child-sized figure clinging to the taller one. Beyond them, Luke could just make out the shadowy forms of three assailants, moving slowly and confidently in on them. In the hand of one of them, he caught the glint of a blade. There was no time to waste, and exactly one route that had any chance of getting Luke to them in time. It would take a hefty jump, but nothing that a Jedi drawing on the Force couldn't easily handle. The only imponderable was whether the canyonade's safety tractor beams would react fast enough to snatch him in midair and whisk him helplessly away. There was only one way to find out. "Wait here, R2," he murmured. Stretching out to the Force, he hopped over the slideway to the top of his sky arch's guard wall. For a pair of heartbeats, he crouched there, steadying his balance as he did one final visual measurement of the distance up and across to the other sky arch. Then, taking a deep breath, he again drew on the force and leaped. The emergency tractor beams were obviously not as hair-trigger as he'd feared, and he reached the other side without so much as a nudge from them. Catching the top of the other sky arch's guard wall, he swung his legs through the opening between guard wall and roof to land in a slight crouch on the non-moving section of the walkway. He took in the tableau laid out before him in a glance. The two prospective victims, as he'd already seen, were standing ahead and to his right, their backs pressed against the guard wall. The hood on the taller of them had slipped back, revealing the lined face and white hair of an old woman. The face of the child clinging to her side, most likely a grandchild or even great-grandchild, considering the woman's age, was still completely in shadow. But Luke didn't need to see an expression. The way the child clutched the old woman's side was all the evidence anyone needed to recognize the silent terror there. A terror that was well-founded. From the lower sky arch, Luke had seen three knife-wielding men closing in on them. Now, from his new vantage point, he could see that those three were merely the inner circle of a much larger group. Nine other men were standing a few paces farther back, forming a semicircle around their intended prey. All nine of them had the hardened faces of men whose lives had been shaped by violence and cruelty. All nine had blasters out and ready. And at the moment, all nine of those faces and five of those blasters were pointed at Luke.
"That's far enough,"
Luke called, straightening up from his landing crouch.
"Put down your weapons."
"I've got a better idea,"
one of the men snarled, his voice as nasty as his appearance.
"Why don't you turn around and walk away while you still can?"
"I don't think so,"
Luke said, trying to sound more confident than he felt. With five, six now blasters trained on him, it was going to be a race to see whether he could get his lightsaber out fast enough to deflect the shots that would be coming in his direction the instant he made a move toward the weapon. But there was the slideway 2 steps to his left, one section going each direction, both moving at reasonably high speed.
"We're wasting time,"
one of the other men spat.
"Burn him, and let's..."
And in that instant, in the middle of the sentence, the child moved. It was so quiet and so smooth that at first Luke didn't realize what was happening. The child rotated out of his panicked death grip on the old woman toward the nearest of the knife-wielding assailants, one arm swinging across the man like a stylized slap across his chest that fell short of its intended mark. The arm movement seemed to deflect the child like a ricocheted stone toward the second assailant, the slapping movement again, and he was now swinging toward the third man. And with a gurgling gasp, the first man collapsed into a heap on the ground. Someone swore with startled viciousness, the blasters pointed at Luke, wavering, as sudden confusion intruded on what had 2 seconds earlier been a solidly secure situation. Heads turned back toward the child and his grandmother, and then the second man crumpled, and the third man started to do the same, his knife now inexplicably in the child's hand, but only briefly. An instant later, with an abbreviated flick of the wrist, the knife flashed across the short distance to bury itself in the chest of one of the other assailants. And as it did so, the hood fell back far enough to finally expose the child's face. It wasn't a child beneath that cloak. It was a Nogri. That single glance was the last clear view any of them had of the alien. For some, it was the last clear view of anything they would ever have. Even as Luke grabbed for his lightsaber, the Nogri became a blur of motion, diving, rolling, slashing with blades now in both hands, evading the frantic sputtering of blaster shots with casual ease. A grenade clattered to the walkway at the old woman's feet, vanished as Luke reached out through the Force to maneuver it through the gap between guard wall and roof and send it hurling straight up. By the time it exploded harmlessly far above them, the battle was over.
"Master Skywalker,"
the Nogri said, nodding gravely from the center of the carnage as he slid his 2 assassin's knives back into concealment.
"I am honored by your presence and grateful for your assistance."
"Such as it was," Luke said, shaking his head in astonishment. He'd seen Nogri in training and practice combat, and had thought he knew the limits of their fighting skills. He hadn't even been close. "Somehow I think you would have managed quite well without me."
"Your pardon, but that is not true,"
the Nogri demurred, stepping over the bodies and coming over to him.
"Your distraction was most timely, allowing me nearly 4 extra seconds I would otherwise not have had."
"Not to mention the grenade,"
the old woman added. She had crouched down beside one of the dead and was going through his pockets with practiced fingers.
"If not for your quick action, we could have all been killed. Thank you."
"You're welcome," Luke said, eyeing her with growing doubts as she finished her search and moved on to the next body. A Nogri warrior and a woman with the expertise of a professional pickpocket were not exactly what he'd had in mind when he'd come leaping to the rescue. May I ask who you are?
Not who you're probably afraid I am,
the woman said, pausing in her search to flash him a smile.
It's really quite honest and mostly respectable. My name is Miranda Savage. Takmarak here is currently attached to me as my bodyguard. We work for an old acquaintance of yours, Talon Card.
Really? Luke said. Oddly enough, I was just thinking about trying to make contact with Card.
Well, you've come to the right place,
Miranda said, straightening up.
He's just arrived on Sejansage.
You're joking, Luke said, frowning. What's he doing here?
Whoever knows what Card's doing anywhere,
Miranda countered philosophically.
Why don't you come along and ask him yourself?
Luke looked down through the guard wall at the city lights below. Once again, he'd managed to be in the right place at the right time. The Force was indeed with him. Thank you, he said to Miranda. I believe I will. Chief? Card looked up from his desk to find Dankin's head poking around the open office doorway.
Yes, what is it?
Savage and a Nogri guard are here, Dankin's said. She's got the data drop you wanted.
Good,
Card said, frowning slightly. Back when the Wild Card's bridge crew had been preparing to spring Booster Tarek's errant venture on the unsuspecting Hasishi, Dankin had been wearing a half-concealed grin. He was wearing the same grin now.
And?
Card prompted. The grin came fully out of concealment.
And they also brought you a surprise.
Really? Card said, letting the temperature of his voice cool a couple of degrees.
I hope you remember how much I like surprises. You'll like this one, Chief,
Dankin assured him, stepping aside and gesturing. Plakmarak and Miranda Savage emerged around the doorway and stepped into the office, the latter holding a data drop cylinder in her hand, and coming in behind them.
Well, I'll be kesseled,
Card said, getting to his feet.
A pleasant surprise indeed. Hello, Skywalker.
Card,
Skywalker nodded in greeting.
I'm surprised to find you here.
The feeling is mutual,
Card agreed.
Are you alone?
R2's with me,
Skywalker said, nodding back over his shoulder.
He spotted a G29T repair droid working off your cargo bay and stopped for a chat.
I hope he enjoys it,
Card said, taking the cylinder from Miranda and glancing at its markings.
That's the last G2 I'm ever going to buy. Any trouble, Miranda?
We were jumped on the way back,
she told him.
12 men, very professional. No indications as to who they were working for.
Probably one of the Hutts, Card said, turning the cylinder over in his hand.
They weren't exactly thrilled about losing this.
Could be,
Miranda said.
Whoever they were, Plakmarak took care of them.
Wish assistance from Master Skywalker,
the Nogri added in his gravelly voice.
He arrived at exactly the proper moment.
Jedi Masters have that knack, Card said dryly, handing the cylinder back to Miranda.
Good. Take it to O'Donnell. Then you can go and relax in the crew lounge while he checks it out and issues your payment.
Would you be interested in taking on another assignment?
Only if it's more fun than courier work,
Miranda said.
Apart from the attack, it was all rather boring.
She waved a hand each toward Luke and Plakmarak.
And with these two around, even that part wasn't very exciting.
I'll try to do better the next time,
Card promised.
As a matter of fact, I have one job in particular where your talents might prove useful.
Check back here after you've been paid, and we'll talk, all right?
Fine,
Miranda said, nodding. Plakmarak gave an abbreviated Nogri bow, and together they left the office. Card cocked an eyebrow at Skywalker.
Thank you for your help. I believe it's now my turn to owe you one.